Hey, it's Don Coscarelli, filmmaker. I just wrote a book. Check it out. It's called Fiction, Tales from the World of Phantasm. And it can teach you all the things that you never knew about the Phantasm film series. A lot of interesting stuff. Horror, violence, not much sex. Check it out. Now available on Amazon, paperback, and Kindle.
This is The Gala Show. I'm your reporter on the beat, Gala Avery. On this episode, you may know my guest as an award-winning music video director who has worked with influential acts such as TV on the Radio, Gnarls Barkley, Yeah Yeah Yeahs, and Rihanna, the creative director of the immersive installation An Encounter with Lux Prima at the Gagosian Marciano in Los Angeles, or as the filmmaker behind the feature-length documentary titled Shot, the Psycho-Spiritual Mantra of Rock, all about the photographer that shaped our modern zeitgeist, Mick Rock. But here on The Gala Show, I know my guest as the director of The Seating, Barnaby Clay. Hi, Barnaby.
Hi, Gala.
How are you?
I'm good. Happy to be here in my office.
In your office. Yeah. I am too. Which, by the way, has amazing posters, which we've already established, are some of which are from Dave from Exotic Originals.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure elsewhere. He has an amazing The Devil's poster, you guys. I'm so jealous of it. And he has a little VHS collection over in the corner.
I do, yeah. So. That's like a small... Basically, I had a huge collection, and when I left England, I sadly had to get rid of most of them, and also a giant Laserdisc collection.
Oh, I love Laserdisc.
Yeah, and they all, and of course, I got rid of them at the time when everything was like worthless, and so I kind of just gave them all away. But what you're seeing there is mainly from the Warner Home Archive, which just like, for some reason, when we were collecting videos when we were a kid, like those were like the really, in England, like the really, the ones that we went for, you know, those were the really exciting finds when you'd see like those particular ones. But also in there are some which are like, I don't know, I grew up in the video nasty era.
Oh yeah,
the
video nasty.
And
yeah.
So some of those are like,
well, like Motel Hell. Is that a video nasty?
No, I don't think that is.
That's
but
so
I think
funny. I
Drink Your Blood, Zombie Holocaust.
Of course.
AKA Zombie Flesh Eaters.
Oh, and Evil Dead 2. The only movie scarier than Evil Dead is Evil Dead 2. That's the tagline here in America. Yeah. I'm not sure if that was
really
the same tagline in the UK.
Which is so unscary, which is funny. but yeah, and just some of them are like just great movies. Like, you know, I can see Being There. Network.
I love that movie.
Day for Night.
And of course, he has Busting, which we covered on Video Archives.
I have Busting. Yeah, Busting. Exactly. It's a kind of random collection there.
I like it.
My Name is Nobody. Like, just like, it's got a lot of interesting titles. But those are my little cherries. That's what's left of kind of like a certain part of my youth.
Of the collection.
Yeah.
So before we bring up the topic for today, I have a question for you. How did becoming a father change you as a creative?
I think two ways. I mean, just on a fundamental level, becoming a father, becoming a parent, is just like, and this is kind of really boring, but at the same time, it's just so true, and there's no avoiding it, is that just time management. You just realize that you just like, you have so many hours in the day. If you're going to like write a movie, you got to find those hours and you got to stick to those hours, and you can't just like, there's no like, okay, I'll see you like, you know, a few hours later, unless you've got like amazing childcare or you've got like your wife or partner or whatever is like willing to just sit there and do all the work. You've got to like, you know, yeah, you got to work those hours. You got those 5 hours. You got to get busy.
And sleep, I'm sure.
And
also,
sleep like, as well. Yeah. Use... I mean, you know, he's 8, so it's like less about that. But then on a, I guess a more, let's say, existential level. I've spoken about this a few times in relation to my movie. Like, my movie was kind of, The Seating was partially inspired by my wife's pregnancy and the idea of this child coming to my life, basically. And not just because it's not like some weird Rosemary's Baby situation, but more just on a level of like, I think when these things happen to you, i.e. like you have kids for the first time, or you lose somebody very important in your life. You go mm-hmm. through death, like when I lost my father, for example, like really like big, huge, the biggest deals in life. When you go through that, you just go, during that period, you kind of go into a bit of a heightened state and you start thinking about kind of things on a pretty large
global level.
Yeah.
Universal level. Yeah,
you do. And it's really interesting. And you think about what's really important and what isn't and all these kind of things. And I think that definitely seeped into the writing process when I was writing The Seeding, you know. So certainly it helped there. It just opened my eyes on that level. But other than that, I don't know. Enjoy life, enjoy your work. Like, you know, makes me very grateful that I'm able to do something that I love doing, you know. And I hope that my son has the same situation. He finds something like that.
That he just loves his passion.
Yeah, I was really lucky because my parents were both actors, you know, so I kind of like grew up in that situation like you did with your father. Mm-hmm. Just like, you're just kind of, it was like there around you.
Yeah, you can't escape it.
No, you
can't.
That's
the thing.
When
people ask me why do you do what you do? And it's like, well, it's kind of just like in my blood.
Yeah.
I grew up with it everywhere.
Absolutely.
I grew up on set. I grew up on Rules of Attraction. Jay Baruchel, I have photos of him like with me over his shoulder, like running around with me. I think my photo, we have like fake family photos with Eric Stoltz.
Yeah.
Like my mom, my brother and I are his fake family in the movie.
Yeah, nice.
And then we also have our real family photo from that day. Like my dad stepped
that's
in instead.
Amazing.
So it's like, it's just interwoven.
Yeah, yeah. I remember like, I think one of the, like a great moment, but also a really like sad moment in my youth was my dad taking me, he didn't work on it, but like, I think one of his like actor friends was in it, was in Doctor Who. He had a major role in Doctor Who. And he took me to see the TARDIS, and it was just like, it was one of those moments where I was really young, and there was the TARDIS, this telephone box, and I walked in expecting to walk into the TARDIS, and I walked into a telephone box with a black drape at the back, and I was just like, this is it? And in that moment, my whole like idea of everything just changed. I was just like, you know... Yeah.
It's when you realize like it was make-believe.
Yes.
I've had when I was on the set of Silent Hill as a kid, when I learned that Pyramid Head was a ballerina.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I'm not that scared anymore.
Exactly.
I learned.
Yeah.
Now, as always, my guest gets to bring their topic to the mic. Barnaby, why don't you tell us what your topic is and why you decided to choose it?
Okay. So obviously, I mean, two of the most important things in my life are film, obviously. And then the other big thing for me growing up was growing up with a autistic brother who's 8 years older than me. And he, you know, there's just no, I have a sister as well, who's 7 years older than me, but like when you grow up in that family dynamic, there is just no escaping how that's going to shape you mm-hmm. as a person and change the way your outlook on life and your view on everything. And I kind of wanted to talk about Lawrence. That's my brother. You know, he's an artist and he's really interesting, but, you know, he lives in a assisted living house in mm-hmm. England. But, you know, I was like, how can I make that relevant today to this conversation? And I was just thinking about the films that we watched together when we grew up, which was really, I guess, you know, from, I grew up in the like age of, I remember getting the first like VHS player, you know.
Wow.
So
a good age to grow up in.
Yeah, great, you know. So we, you know, we watched a lot of movies together, and because my brother is the way he is, even as he got older, he tends to like a bit like a kid does, rewatch things over and over and over and over again, you know, mm-hmm. and even just bits of things, you know, obsessively. So, and it's just it was a random mix of films that he chose, and I just wanted to talk about those. Yeah, but before we get into the topic, it's time for our commercial break.
Thank you.
I might be vegetarian, but that doesn't mean I can't enjoy a good spice rub. My favorite place to get them is Smoked Bros, a veteran-owned and operated business that sells premium handcrafted dry rubs, spice blends, and seasonings. Psst, guys, you can even put it on your popcorn. My favorites are Honey Badger, because he doesn't give a bleep, and jelly and peanut flavor topping, because some things just taste better together. The website even has recipes, so go check out smokedbros.com to support a veteran-owned and operated business and fill your cabinet with delicious flavor.
And we're back.
So you heard it here. We are going to be talking about Lawrence and the movies that he showed Barnaby. I have 30 minutes on the clock and our time starts now.
Okay.
So Barnaby has written up kind of a list on this whiteboard of movies. And also, I'm sorry, is that The Prisoner at the bottom? McGowan show?
No, it's not. It's not.
I was like.
I put that on because it's something else we watched together. It's a TV show. And that is Prisoner Cell Block H.
Okay, because at first I was like, Prisoner and Patrick McGowan, I had to bring that up.
Yeah, which is awesome and amazing, but this you've probably never heard of.
No, so tell me about it.
But it's really interesting. So somehow we both got into this, and also a lot of my friends got into this, male friends, which is so weird, like young boys watching this. It is a Australian soap opera which started in 79 and went up to 86, mm-hmm. and it's set in a woman's prison, and it's basically like a
woman's prison. It's basically women in prison genre.
Yeah, yes, it's that. So, but it's like kind of really cheap.
So it's not exploitation.
It's not, but it was just amazing. It's just like for some reason, like, but it had all the characters you want from that. It had like the main character who was called B. Smith, and she was like really butch and. Kind of like you rooted for her. She just wanted to, like, you know, you just got behind her, you know. Yeah. And then there was like the wicked warden who I think they all called Vinegar Tits, you know. And you know, and they were all kind of brawny Aussie ladies. Yeah. And they, like, there was like one episode I just thought it was kind of like revolutionary in a way, because there was a lot of gay sex, mm-hmm. on it. There was a lot of I remember the one episode where they did mushrooms, you know.
And so it was like a really progressive show.
It was progressive, yeah, in its weird kind of way. And it was pretty, like, it was very cheap. Like, it was one of these, like, walls wobbling, mm-hmm. in the sets kind of vibe. But we were so invested. And just imagine, I mean, this is like, I started watching it when I was quite young, but, you know, I was still watching it when we were, like, I don't know, 17 or 18. Just imagine, mm-hmm. a group of like 17-year-old dudes sitting around, like, so excited to watch this weird
Aussie women, yeah, in prison show.
Yeah, it was so random. But anyway, I used to watch this with Lawrence, and it was something that, again, he would get excited by. He just liked, I don't know, a lot of these things, films that I'm going to select, I don't really know exactly what appealed
to him
about them. Some of them make a lot more sense
than others.
Yeah. But with that, it's just a combination of just like, I think it was just really fun, mm-hmm. and just seeing like kind of like that kind of bullies and people, yeah. standing up for them and, you know, that kind of dynamic, just like he just got behind it like we all did.
So the movies on your list seem to range from like 72, I think, to 87. I think that's kind of the latest one.
That's right, yeah.
Were you watching these on VHS with him, or were you kind of watching these when they came out? Like, how old were you?
I was probably, this is probably from about, I'd say like, let's say 9 or 10 to like, I don't know, 17, 18.
So really your formative years of cinema.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you,
I mean, I was watching lots of other movies,
of course,
as well.
But these were like the ones that your brother decided to show you.
These are the ones that he was like, he would, if we would sit to watch a movie together, he would want to watch, and he would want to watch over and over again.
So which one, you said there's some that make more sense than others on this list. Which one does not make any sense to you?
I mean, like Breaking Away, for example, okay. That's okay. Like a really interesting one. P.T. Yates, 79. fantastic movie, obviously, you know. I can tell you why I love it, you know. Again, it's just like you're rooting for these characters. They're underdogs, cutters. I actually bought him a T-shirt recently. I found a T-shirt online which said cutters.
And oh, really?
Yeah, he was psyched to have that. But I think maybe, again, because of who he was, him being an underdog himself, mm-hmm. in a way, and an outsider, I think he identified with these kids.
Yeah, with the outsiders.
Yeah. And I think that message of it. But he was just like, the easier ones are the ones where they have lots of action or something like that, where he would just kind of like get more, you know, he'd just want to watch the action or the humor or something like that. But with Breaking Away, it just seemed a bit more nuanced. And I'm not really like 100% why he was just, and he was really into it. Like, he must have watched it like 100 times or more. Yeah, just like, I mean, obsessively watching these films, you know. And sometimes not the whole film, just bits, the bits he liked, mm-hmm. you know. And he likes the bits, like, I remember him liking the bits where I feel like, what's he called again?
I haven't seen it. This is one of the ones I haven't seen. God. I told Barnaby beforehand, so I looked at this list, and there's a few I have seen, like Man with a Golden Gun. Everyone knows I love Nick Knack. He likes to watch. It's my favorite Bond henchman. But like Breaking Away, I haven't seen. This is so embarrassing for people. I haven't seen Blues Brothers.
I've never seen Blues Brothers.
I've never seen Rita Sue and Clockwise.
Okay, all
right. So those are the ones I haven't seen.
Clockwise, I'd expect, you know, see, because it's such a, like, I feel like that was such an, like, English film. Yeah. I don't really know whether it ever really came out here.
Well, now I'm going to have to search these ones down. Like, this is my excuse to watch Blues Brothers, finally.
Okay, so let's start with Man with the Golden Gun. We obviously watched, you know, in England growing up, we watched every Bond film. Mm-hmm. It was on TV the whole time.
Who's your favorite Bond?
Roger Moore.
Oh, that's mine too. Okay,
yeah. I mean, you know, again, we're good. I grew up with him. You know, that's the thing. You grow up, you choose. I mean, you know, I could appreciate the sophistication and roughness of, like, Sean Connery, you know, the raw sexuality of him, but, like, I don't know, there's something about, like, Roger Moore in a safari suit like, you know, just delivering one of his silly lines, which is just so irresistible, you know. So
so out of all the Bond, though, Man with the Golden Gun was the one you chose.
For some reason he loved that one. I really enjoyed it as well. I mean, obviously it's got Christopher Lee in, so mm-hmm. you know, immediately for me, that's just amazing. And it's got Hervé.
My man Hervé. I love Hervé. And I love
it. And it's got two great Bond girls. It's got Bridget.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
And also one of the greatest, like, fights between Bond and, like, the Bond, like, the women henchmen, like, in that pool area.
Yes, of course. And
Bambi and Thumper.
Bambi and Thumper. Is that, no?
Is that them?
No, that's...
Am I thinking that's Diamonds Are Forever?
Diamonds Are Forever.
Okay, there you go. Yeah. I always... Because I also love Diamonds Are Forever.
I love that one as well. I love those two henchmen.
Yeah, with Crispin's dad, Crispin Glover's dad.
Oh my God.
So great.
Oh, yeah. He's one of the... Oh, yes, I know exactly who he is. Oh my God, because he looks like him.
Yeah.
Holy shit. Oh my God, you just blow my mind. Wow. I did not know that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. That's cool.
So this was the Bond of choice in your house.
It was. And Lawrence liked that. He liked... Oh, you know what he really liked? I remember he liked, for some reason, he liked that cop who was in... He was... Sheriff J.W. Pepper, and he was like in one of the other ones as
he's
well.
In like three or four of them. Yeah, he
was in like Live and Let Die as well. I think. Yeah, he like pops up.
And he's in a few of them. It's like he's one of the reoccurring characters. Yeah, when you look online, he's one of them.
Lawrence really liked him. He thought he was funny. It's got some great stunts and stuff. I think he also, Lawrence got some like weird kind of like kinks, body kinks, you know. Yeah. And I think he liked Scaramanga's third nipple as well. Yeah. You know? Somehow that was kind of
to me, it's what elevates Bond.
Yeah.
It's not just like a real life movie. It's kind of like all the villains and everything have like these like little quirks to them, and they really stand out.
Yeah,
like with Jaws, like with his big jaws and stuff.
Lawrence loved Jaws as well because he likes those. He liked those villains, and they always appealed to him. The bigger, the weirder, the better, actually. And there's one other on this list if we're talking of villains, I'm going to jump down to Stir Crazy.
Oh, Stir Crazy. Oh, my God. Sidney Good Poitier. Thing my dad's not in this room because he was right, whop, whop, like whenever when they go first go to prison and Gene Wilder realizes he, every time Stir Crazy gets brought up, my dad goes crazy for it. I love Stir Crazy.
I love Stir Crazy as well. And Lawrence loved Grossberger, you know, that character. He loved him. He loved, you know, how I feel like, you know, he's my brother's like, he at a certain point he was like really skinny when he was growing up when he was a kid, and then he like wanted to get big.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like some of that was like he wanted to be like Grossberger. Wow. Which is quite weird, but like he was just and so that I mean, you know, he also just adored Richard Pryor, and you know, and
one of the greats.
Yeah. The pairing of those two in that is
I think it's one of the greatest comedic pairings of all time. To be honest.
Totally, 100%.
Because in that weird situation, almost Richard Pryor has to play the straight man in a lot of the scenes. Which is so not Richard Pryor.
Yeah.
So the fact that Gene Wilder's personality is just so much bigger than you would expect.
I know. Yeah, I mean, the moment they first get into prison.
Yeah.
It's just incredible, man. Anyway, so that, I mean, Stir Crazy was like pretty much on repeat for about like 10 years in the house. It was just always on, and like every line just, I just remember it. I just remember every scene of that. So that was fun. Silent Running.
I haven't seen that in forever.
I've not seen it for a long, long time.
My dad showed that to me when I was a kid.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember the poster and like that's it.
Yeah, I just remember like I have a very like warm, fond memory of it. It's just like one of the, although I kind of also remember this like this sadness in it as well. Yeah. It's like,
that's what I remember. I remember it's a it's kind of melancholy.
It is, yeah. It's this kind of like disillusionment with kind of, with authority and with, you know, it's very much it's, what is it, 72, so it's just coming off the back of the 60s, and that it was definitely like in that period of film which was really reflecting this like, oh shit, like things aren't so beautiful. I'm not just like planting my beautiful garden and that's it, you know. But again, Lawrence, he was like, he got really obsessed by the robots, Huey and Dewey. And it's so funny because you see it now and it's kind of like, I don't know, it's a bit like Dark Star or something where you see it and you're like, it's like so basic.
Well, there's a lot of like the kind of like science fiction of that time is like that. Like when I rewatched Logan's Run recently, it's like, oh my God, the set design is beautiful and everything is so beautiful in it. But then you just see that little train going by and it's just like a little like cardboard train. And it's awesome, but it is very simple. Like, and Dark Star is like that, and so is Silent Running.
Yeah, but it was, there was something in the robots which just felt like, even though you can see it's like two people
in a suit,
like sort of stumbling around in their funny walk, making weird noises, they were really lovable. And I mean, you know, obviously, like, you know, that's so much to do with Bruce Dern and his performance and how he interacts with them, and but yeah, that was, again, it was just like, some, maybe that was one as well that I was a little confused why it was so appealing to Lawrence.
It might have been the robots, though. He seems like he likes, from what I've heard so far, like, likes characters, likes unique, likes kind of quirky.
Yeah.
Like something that stands out.
Yeah, and I think he, you know, honestly, he didn't have a lot of friends growing up. He still doesn't have a lot of friends, like close friends, and it's a hard thing for him to have. And I think there was a part of him which, there still is a part of him who liked the idea of this companionship through robots, you know. I remember him, I remember my mom coming back from the sea. My family, I had some family here in the States, and she used to come visit them. And one day she came back from visiting my aunt in New York, and she had what she said was a robot, and we were like really excited. And it was not a robot. It was basically a kind of remote control, like like car or something mm-hmm. base with an inflatable robot on top of it.
She tried her best.
Yeah, but he was like so excited at this idea, this robot in the house, you know? So I think that was something which actually was kind of...
Which really drew to him.
Yeah, so...
And Christine, too, kind of has that technological aspect to it.
Yeah, Christine... So again, this is like the underdog kid being picked on, got no friends at school. Lawrence always going on about this character, Cunningham, you know, mm-hmm. which is his name in it. And yeah, and just it's the idea, because, you know, he's still, my brother still talks about like the bullies in his school, you know.
Wow.
And they weren't that bad or anything like that, but it's just like they're just fixated, these kind of like bogeymen mm-hmm. in his mind. He's sort of fixated on them still. And I think this idea, the story of like a kid who is picked on and has a terrible time at school and then suddenly gets this car who goes out and just kills off all the bullies.
And not only that, but it's also like it's like a loving relationship that yeah. he has oh, with yeah. his car. Even if it's like an obsessive relationship, yeah. it's still one that like can't really be broken.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I can see how powerful that would be, especially if it's like going to go and kill all those bad people that are terrible to you. Yeah. Like, I wouldn't really mind that sometimes.
Totally, yeah, yeah. And I think also it was just, there was an element in that of... My, like I just mentioned, my aunt, he was very close to my aunt who lived in Coney Island mm-hmm. and he used to go out and stay with her every year. And he was just a big, just lover of America and all things American. Mm-hmm. And so I think the car, this like
very awesome, American car.
Like Cadillac
Red.
Thunderbird, you know, it was just beautiful car that. It's again this kind of yeah he loved that as well, so that was then yeah
that's my dad's favorite movie, by the way, Clockwork Orange.
Oh really?
Of all time, it's my dad's favorite movie.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's pretty high up there for me, I've got to say. You know, I just watched it again last Christmas. I had last Christmas Day.
Wow.
I had COVID and my family deserted me because I had COVID and it was all looking kind of disastrous. But then I realized I was just like, oh yeah, I can just sit and watch whatever I want to watch.
So you watch Clockwork Orange.
So I watched Clockwork Orange, which is a really like un-Christmas Day movie, but it was perfect and I enjoyed it so much. But yeah, that's a weird one because I think like I that was obviously, I think a little later we watched that because I was maybe too young to watch it when I was 10 or something.
I was going to say, it might be the most violent movie on the list.
Yeah, for sure.
And I've argued this so many times when I talk about A Clockwork Orange, but it's an anti-violence movie.
Oh, it is.
100%.
Yeah,
it's like
yeah.
my favorite movie is Bugsy Malone.
Oh,
and my
wow.
dad's
yeah,
is Clockwork
okay.
Orange, and they're both anti-violence
yeah.
films. And I always tell people misunderstand A Clockwork Orange for being a super violent like
yeah.
condoning violence? No, it's
no.
it's an anti-violent movie.
100%.
But
yeah.
it is the most violent film on this list.
It's definitely violence in there. Interesting you bring up Bugsy Malone because, like, I had a weird relationship with that when I was
oh,
a
yeah.
kid. Yeah. I was a pretty, like extreme empath as a
yeah.
child. Very empathetic and big, overwhelming imagination. And I used to get really like concerned by certain things that happened to people in films, but mm-hmm. also in real life. Like for example, when I was at school, I think I was about 4 or 5. Mm-hmm. After the spring break, we came back to school and one of the kids had gone skiing and broken his arm and
wow.
they put his arm in a cast.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt terrible for this kid and did not want to go and... I just felt so bad. I felt like it was just like
you could feel it yourself.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't really understand. I was just like that it was something there to fix his arm, but it just looked so awful. And anyway, so I didn't go to school for about like, I don't know. I just refused to go to school. This poor guy. Anyway, Bugsy Malone has this moment where he's obviously the pie guns,
oh,
right?
When they're testing the gun and
it hits
knuckles.
Yeah, and
yeah.
it's like all over him and it
oh,
kind
God.
Of covers in him. And for some reason, this just gave me this weird, irrational fear. And it terrified me.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's so odd.
But you know, that's a great reading because it's my favorite movie, so I watch it like every birthday. Yeah. Like I have the Laserdisc of it. And I've never heard someone say that they were like terrified by a moment in it. No, but it's really kind of important in a weird way. Yeah. I've never even, because that moment with Knuckles when Knuckles gets splurged is really sad. Like when he's like crying over him.
Yeah.
So
yeah. He's like mummified in there. Like he can't breathe. You know, this poor kid, you know.
Wow.
Also just found it really weird actually watching that movie growing up.
Well, it is really weird. I mean, like she's playing a prostitute.
Yeah,
and she
I
plays
know.
A prostitute twice that year because Taxi Driver.
Taxi Driver, yeah, exactly.
And like there are children with babies in the movie, like calling out from the. It's a very strange movie.
It is brilliant, but like, it's hard to get your head around at that age. So Clockwork Orange was like something we watched together a lot. I was like fully invested in that as well. Obviously, like I just said, and I think what appealed to him was. There's some random stuff that he liked. Like he really liked. He liked the scene with the cat lady, you know, and it's a really like vicious scene, obviously. But he just something just like it's kind of like perverse about this, like him. Alex like picking up this penis sculpture and like ramming
it's very Ken Russell.
It's super Ken Russell. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's also the combination of the humor in it as well. That's the thing. You it's there throughout the movie. That's what makes it bearable as a movie. Mm-hmm. It's funny. It's like the script is witty and. Malcolm McDowell is just absolutely like brilliant the way he delivers everything, and mm-hmm. And also as are all the other characters, you know, who come in there and pass through it. So, and the other thing was, I do remember growing up, we had in my mum's my parents' record collection, we had the Clockwork Orange soundtrack as well, which is still to me like. One of the greatest soundtracks.
Did he listen to that soundtrack also over and over?
It was just there in our house, and I think we heard it. And it's unusual. I'm not really sure why they had it, because I don't think they like Clockwork Orange at all. But, like, I mean, my mum was showing me, like, she's, like, into, like, poetry, and she's showing me, like, Les Enfants du Paradis is her favorite film, you know? Like, she just... I mean, she hasn't seen my film The Seeding, and she would never see it, because she wouldn't get through the first... 2 minutes of it. But anyway, we did enjoy the Clockwork Orange a lot, and in all its kind of twisted fun. Also, I think the other thing he really responded to is like, even though it's in this like weird future world, it's very English, you know.
Yeah, it is.
It's like it's got like Kubrick always like brought in these like crazy like Leonard Rossiter, these like very weird, funny. English character
super British,
actors
and
which just added this extra layer to them, which was just fantastic. Moving on to the Blues Brothers, John Landis, 1980. Bit more obvious for him, he just was like obsessed by the car chases,
The cars again, and also like the buddy aspect of it,
the buddy aspect. But I think it was just the mass destruction, like, because there is no car chase which has as much
destruction,
ridiculous over the top destruction, and it is so absurd. And then he likes, you know, the stuff with the kind of the neo-Nazis, like all getting like pushed off the bridge, and
don't
like,
we all like that though?
Oh yes, we do. Yes, of course we do. Yeah, yeah, and also of course the music. It's just like it was so fun, but I think it was the more than anything the kind of like cartoon levels of, I mean, just like the end of it. You know, when they eventually. Reached Steven Spielberg, who's the what is he like, the tax collector or something?
Yeah.
And just, you know, the car just like falls apart at the end, you know, that classic moment. But okay,
so Cuckoo's Nest, that's not One Flew
that
Over.
Is
okay, it is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Okay,
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, 1975, Milos Forman. So
I love Brad Dourif, by the way. I have to say my other crush, Brad Dourif.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, God, what a like supporting cast as well. I mean, you know, everybody goes on about Jack Nicholson. Well, Louise Fletcher.
I'm a huge Star Trek fan. Kai Winn from DS9, Louise Fletcher. And then, of course, Brad Dourif as Suter in Voyager for his one episode arc. Yeah. I'm obsessed.
Yeah. But then there's like Danny DeVito.
Just random Danny
and
DeVito.
Like Michael Berryman, who went on to do like The Hills Have Eyes and like and that other guy, I always forget his name. He was like in Ghost and also one of my favorite films, Taking Off. Also Milos Forman.
Okay.
Oh, it's Milos Forman's first film in America.
Taking Off. Okay, now I have to add this.
You have
list.
To see that.
Okay.
It's one of the most underseen, brilliantly funny comedies to come out of America in that period. It is amazing. It's like very funny. Anyway, Cuckoo's Nest, honestly, I think it was just like the combination of seeing these, you know, Lawrence, when he was growing up, he moved through different schools. Some schools were regular schools where he'd be put in maybe a special class or something. Mm-hmm. And some schools were more for kids with special needs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a part of his kind of coping with who he is and the problems that he's had, he liked to kind of like, you know, for want of a better way of putting it, kind of like laugh at people who had worse problems than him.
As a way of coping, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, and I'm always
or
telling
even
him.
Relating, not even
yeah,
just
relating, but sometimes it is laughing at them, you know. Yeah. It is. And I tell him, I'm like, you shouldn't judge these people just because you feel like they are worse off than you, you know. But like, that's his thing. That's, you know, his prerogative. But he, but again, it's very funny. Mm-hmm. It has some like crazy people doing crazy stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And also, you know, Jack Nicholson just. Being, Jack you know, Nicholson. He's the supposedly the sane one in there, but he's like, and he loved this idea of like when he like takes them out for the day and takes them on the boat and like, it's just such a beautiful scene for one, and I think I could see Lawrence and some of his
compatriots,
being in that situation and being this ragtag gang of weirdos, but like having a lot of fun, and you know, I think he liked that aspect to it, and he also really liked, again, talking about the kind of bogeymen. Mm-hmm. You know, he really responded to her, to Louise Fletcher, and her like there. You know, he, because Lawrence used to talk about this. The wicked dairy lady at school. He had some woman.
Well, there's Louise Fletcher, the wicked dairy
exactly.
lady.
Exactly. Yeah.
Who
yeah.
She kind of is
and
in that movie.
So he saw that and he was just like, of course it's got like the most bittersweet, sad ending, but it's bittersweet.
Again, melancholy, kind of like breaking away.
Yeah,
it's like
there
is a little bit of, and I mean, Silent Running is the melancholy one.
Exactly.
It's kind of
again,
a little bit of that going through that.
That 70s period, they were into that. Yeah. Then we move on to Stir Crazy, which we kind of done.
But what about Rita, Sue, and Bob 2? Because I have never seen this movie.
Okay.
I've actually never even heard of this movie.
Do you know who Alan Clarke is?
Yes.
Okay, so he was like, he's very influential. I mean, like, I think, like, Harmony Korine and Gus Van Sant all were pretty obsessed by him. He is a British filmmaker from the 80s who did a lot of very, like, tough, kind of gritty street movies, like urban movies. He also, you know, and he also famously, he really kind of pushed Steadicam to an extreme as well. There's one movie which is called Elephant, which was actually obviously where Gus Van Sant got Elephant from. And it's all about the IRA, and it just follows essentially a IRA hitman, you know, and it follows one after the other, but it's kind of silent. It's like, I think it's like, you can find it online. It's because it's a short film. It's like, oh, maybe like, I can't remember, half an hour or 40 minutes.
Oh, wow, okay, yeah.
But his films are just intense, and they are, yeah, they are gritty, they are intense. Scum. Do you know Scum?
Yes. Okay. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Now yeah. I know. Now I know where
yeah.
we are.
Yeah. 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 I'm the fucking daddy. You yeah. know.
I know exactly where we
yeah,
are now.
Yeah. So.
So maybe okay, Clockwork Orange and Rita Sue and Bob 2 no, kind of go together.
No, they don't, because the thing is like Rita Sue and Bob 2 is a comedy. Right?
Oh. Okay.
He went and he made this kind of like Mike Lee style, I guess. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really his style, but it is, I guess, akin to like the more like comedic Mike Lee movies. It's very British. It's set in a
where is it set though?
It's set in a housing estate in the north of England, and it is just follows like it's just pretty un-PC now, but it's like it follows like a teacher who's probably like in his maybe like late 30s, like 40, like having a fling with two girls who are like in their late teens, basically. Mm. Two girls together.
Okay. And, not apart.
But not apart. And I mean, literally like jumping in the car, one has a go, jump out the car, the other goes in. But it's very funny, it's very British, and it's very, it's also like, you know, it's just brilliantly well made. Yeah.
Yeah. I know the timer went off, but you only have one movie left on the list. Okay. And we brought up Clockwise, and that was like you said that's the one movie you probably haven't heard of. So yeah. I have to ask about okay. Clockwise before we wrap up.
Well, it's again, really British movie. Lawrence was the other thing we watched on the TV front, like endlessly, which like every kid in England at this time was Fawlty Towers.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love Fawlty Towers. Yeah, okay. Oh, my drama teacher showed me Fawlty Towers.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's just, you know, it's classic and it's brilliant comedy and John Cleese at his finest, you know. Mm-hmm. And so this is John Cleese.
Okay.
And it's directed by Christopher Morahan. It's from 1986. And I don't know this director. I don't really know any. Well, I don't really know much of the other casts in it, but it's a John Cleese movie, and it is John Cleese just doing. It's one of those films where it's basically he's a principal of a school, and he's called to give a lecture somewhere else, mm-hmm. and he has to get there, and it's one of these things where like everything goes wrong, and he has to get, and he's just like. And he's obsessed by time. That's why it's called Clockwise. And they're always like the clock is ticking down and he's got to get there and everything goes wrong. And, you know, it's just watching John Cleese just like tripping up, falling over, like sweating.
So John Cleese at his best.
Yeah, just doing what he does best. Like, you know, beating his car with a branch or whatever it is, you know, on the side of a road. Like classic. So, again, very British movie, but like something that from that period was just, I think people really responded to it, and certainly Lawrence did.
And that is all the time that we have for today. But Barnaby, is there any final thought that you would like to share with the audience?
Oh, final thoughts. Wow. Okay. Well, it's been really interesting talking about this, I should say, because like, you know, I talk about film a lot to people, mm-hmm. and I talk about my brother a lot to people as well, but it's very rare that the two intersect. Yeah. And so that's been really interesting. What else would I like to talk? No, I don't know.
You're like Larry. You're like, I'm done.
Yeah, exactly. No, I just, you know, it's been super fun. And should I talk about my film? Or?
Yeah, you can if you'd like to.
Okay,
Bring up The Seating, which I had a chance to watch, by the way. Okay. I really enjoyed it. Very Woman in the Dunes-esque.
I'm
going to throw that in there. Yes. I haven't actually seen the movie. I read the book, though.
Oh, so. You did? Okay, great. It's a fantastic book. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. I'm a big fan of Kobo Abe, who wrote the book, and the film, which is amazing. And certainly the seed of the idea did come from that, just like the idea of I was like searching for, when I was writing it, I was searching for I just wanted an idea which was contained. And obviously this is like such a fantastic concept to keep somebody in one place.
Yeah.
I needed something like that because I didn't knew I wasn't going to have much money, and I wanted to retain some level of control when I did it. And so that was certainly my starting point, was Woman of the Dunes. Absolutely 100%. But at the same time, I love that movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's kind of almost like a perfect movie, and yeah. I would never want to like remake it.
Yeah, just take inspiration from.
Draw inspiration. And I do believe like where I took it to is a very different place.
Oh, it's completely different. Yes.
It just kind of like I just handily borrowed the setup. Yeah. But yeah. Anyway, it's coming out this week on Friday.
Yeah, I'm very excited.
Which is very excited.
And also, I saw, I think on Instagram, you had a Polaroid up that said that you shot from October 18th to November 6th, 2021. Is that... Okay, I just want to like reiterate for the audience. That's like about a three-week shoot.
Yeah.
People don't realize how difficult a three-week shoot is. I've been on seven-week shoots that like literally I thought I was going to die while I was on them. That's a monumental task. If you talk to directors, like when I talked to Joe Lynch... Eli Roth, my dad, and you talk about how difficult it is to shoot something in such a short amount of time with so little money. It is amazing. The quality of your movie for the budget and the shoot, I was shocked that it was a three-week shoot, to be honest. Yeah. I think it was over the moon fantastic for a three-week shoot.
Thank you.
I was so surprised.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was like impossible nightmare hell that I went through. And you know, I do look at it in those terms sometimes. In my darkest moments, I look at it and I'm just like, wow, for considering, you know.
Oh, definitely consider. And also like, children outdoors,
stunts, like all sorts of stuff. I mean, you know, and the thing that's the funny thing is like I'm writing this story and I'm like, yeah, this is great. It's contained. I've got like essentially two main characters. You know, I'm in this one spot. I'm not going to be moving around too much. And then you're suddenly standing there and you're like in a canyon in Utah, like thousands of miles away from anywhere and any help. And you're like rigging a bunch of like young children to trees up on a ridge and having to build a road just to get to your location. You're like, oh my god, okay, this is not so easy.
It's when you know you're making a movie. You're like, oh my god.
Yeah, I did it was funny. I did the night before, staying in this motel, and the night before the first day of shoot, I just wanted to watch something to get myself, you know, set in the mindset. And I'm not sure whether I chose the best thing. I was like I guess surfing through Criterion Channel, and there was some random German featurette from like the I think early 80s on Herzog. It's an interview interview with him for like German TV or something like that. And
You chose to watch a Herzog interview.
And I watched that and it was great. And I was just like, yeah, this is perfect, you know. And then I guess like 3 days later, I was just thinking, oh, yeah, that really set the tone.
Yeah. You know? It's like him eating his shoe.
Yeah. I'm like, why didn't I just choose something which kind of like would just give me some vibes, the easy vibes, the nice. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, but.
Well, thank you, Barnaby, for coming on the show. If you'd like to keep up with Barnaby, you can do so on Instagram at Out of the Ether. And be sure to check out his new movie, The Seeding, which will be both streaming and in select theaters starting January 26th in the United States and Canada. And of course, for my UK listeners, the film is set to digitally drop on February 12th.
Perfect.
I'm Gala Avery, and this has been The Gala Show. The Gala Show is brought to you by Insertomatic. This episode was executive produced by Roger Avery and produced by Gala Avery. Music composed by Andy Milburn. As always, I'm your host, Gala Avery. Copyright 2023, all rights reserved. Despite me sharing the same last name with this charity, I don't have any affiliation with it, besides the fact the issue is very near and dear to my heart.
Did you know that in the United States, 2.7 million children currently have a parent in prison? And it's estimated that 10 million children have experienced parental incarceration at some point in their lives. I was one of these kids, and as an adult, I am really grateful to be able to give back to Project Avery. Their mission is to build leadership from within by supporting community through programs such as mentoring and outdoor education, and also to remove the stigma surrounding having a parent that's incarcerated. You don't have to feel alone. If you know a kid who could use these resources or would like to donate money or time to the charity, please go to projectavery.org to check out what this amazing charity is all about. Again, that's projectavery.org. Thank you guys from the bottom of my heart.